Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Linda Calhoun, Vice Chair of the Club's International Relations Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Professor Scott Fogelsong is Chair, Department of Musicianship and Music Theory at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. Scott is a pianist, musician, teacher, writer, cat lover, music history devotee, occasional computer geek, sometime programmer. He's also been on the faculty of the San Francisco Conservatory of Music since 1978, and he now serves as department chair in addition to enjoying the honor of educating some of today's most promising young musicians. In 2008, he was named recipient of the Sarlo Family Foundation Award for Excellence in Teaching. He has taught Music 27, which is an intro to music course, for the fall freshman program at UC Berkeley since 1991. And is associated with the San Francisco Symphony, both as a contributing writer and as an inside music lecturer for the symphony's weekly subscription concerts. And he is a program annotator for the California Symphony, New Hampshire Music Festival, and Las Vegas Philharmonic Orchestra, after formerly serving in the same capacity for the Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra. He was formally educated at the Peabody Conservatory in Baltimore and the San Francisco Conservatory. Please join me in welcoming Professor Scott Fogelsong.
Well, good evening to everyone, and I'm so happy to see you here. Yes, we're going to do the talk in the dark. And that's because, of course, our subject tonight is movies. Everybody loves movies, and I'm going to be talking about the music of movies, not musical films or anything like that. I'm going to be talking about that music that you hear underneath the movie while it's all going on, what we call film scores. You know, one of the things I love in life are paradoxes. I just love those sort of things. And the story of cinema music begins with a paradox. And that paradox is that movie music began in silent film. Now, the thing about silent film, though, you should remember, is that silent films weren't really silent. Right from almost the beginning, they were accompanied by music. Either a piano player, for example, or an organ player, or maybe a little chamber group, or even a full orchestra. Now, the real point of it, the real point, was to mask the noise of the projection. And that's what it was all about, okay? That's what it was. But, you know, filmmakers began discovering that there are all kinds of possibilities that could enhance this experience. And that's how it all began, as people began thinking, now, wait a minute, we can do something with this. Life has handed us a lemon. Let's make some lemonade here. And that's what they did. Now, smaller neighborhoods, generally speaking, would have just a pianist playing for the movies. That's that honky-tonk piano that we associate so much with them. But some places would have an organ, like the Castro Theater here does. And in the bigger city theaters, those typically had full orchestras. Now, what's interesting about those orchestras, remember, is that for the most part, they were also playing for vaudeville, because most of those theaters were vaudeville houses. They had various acts would need music, and then the movie would start playing, and the orchestra would very often play for the movie. What's interesting about this is that those orchestras, San Francisco had at least half a dozen of them in the theaters, if not more, were good employment for young musicians. I like to think of them as being the equivalent of what we now have as the Freeway Philharmonic, with all these little orchestras around the Bay Area that the same basic group of people play in. You know, you go to the California Symphony and you see the same first chair as you do at the Berkeley Symphony and then in Napa and so on. And that's what these orchestras were. To give you an example, right around the turn of the 20th century, there was a violinist, a young violinist named Gene Schmitz. And Gene Schmitz was a violinist in the Columbia Theater on Powell Street. Long gone now. he got to the attention of a corrupt city boss, and he became the 26th mayor of San Francisco. He was our mayor during the earthquake, the 06 earthquake and fire. He was also as crooked as Lombard Street. And he wound up getting thrown in jail for corruption starting in 1907. He was in and out of jail for about the next decade over various things, including a stint at San Quentin, I might add. And don't you love our city? Because he got out finally in 1921. He ran for supervisor and won. Yeah, that'll teach you. Yeah. So I guess he got tired of playing the violin, huh? You know. But anyway, he would be one of these young musicians sitting in these theater orchestras. It wasn't much of a living, but it was a living, you know, and these guys played. Now, I'm going to give you a sense of how this all worked. I've taken a clip here from a truly awful movie from 1919 starring the great escape artist Harry Houdini. I don't know if you know this, but he made a lot of movies for a while. None of them were big successes, but he made them. And in this one, what he's doing is what he always did in his movies, and that is that he's escaping from something. The problem is that his escaping was all in real time right there on the screen, but nobody believed it. Because even back then, they knew how well you could edit this sort of stuff. And so his escapes that were so impressive live were not very impressive in the movies. But he did do them live. Now, in this particular scene, this is typical of a Houdini movie. He's been strapped into an electric chair by the villain, and he's got to get out before the villain reaches up and pulls the switch. Meanwhile, the heroine is being menaced by a robot. And the robot is, I'm sure you'll be surprised to hear, is a guy in a great big cardboard suit. Now, we'll hear it first with a kind of piano accompaniment that you would probably hear in a small theater in those days, all right? And it'll give you a chance to study all the subtleties of this magnificent scene, especially Houdini's Olivier-level acting. Oh, it's just magnificent, isn't it? But that kind of a score. Now, if you saw this, though, in a big city, you wouldn't have that piano going on. You'd have an orchestra. And most of what they played, by the way, was out of a big book of cues that the studios made for them. Because obviously, remember, orchestras cannot just make it up on the spot. They have to have full scores, and they have to be sitting there reading. So the studios would provide them with a full set of parts for this thing. Now, they were almost always put together out of previously used music, and they were almost always generic stuff. And by the way, they were going to start using this stuff, and they used it for the next 25 or 30 years. You heard it in almost every movie. So the stuff I took it from comes from the 1930s, but it really doesn't matter. It could have been any time. But it really does enhance the movie quite a bit, and it really could use some enhancing, couldn't it? So here we go with full orchestra. It really helps, doesn't it? Yeah. Lots of fun. Now, you know, when sound came in 1927, it was such an incredible thing that when it started, but it created a problem. And that is that audiences who would accept background music coming from an orchestra right in front of them would not accept it just coming out of the screen. It's like, where is that orchestra? Who's playing that music? What's happening here? You know. So as a result, many of the early sound films did not have background scores. They were also very difficult to do. Now, we have to remember that so much that we take for granted was not available to them. They were recording the music generally right onto phonograph discs. You might have seen the movie Singing in the Rain, where it all goes wrong, you know, so on. So it was often very difficult to get all this stuff synchronized. They couldn't do the kind of editing we can do. Everything had to be kind of done off the cuff. So it added a fortune to any kind of movie to put any kind of background score into it. And if you listen to those early movies, you'll notice that they've got music for the opening and end credits and nothing else in the middle. Now, what's interesting about that, though, is that some of these scenes really benefit from the lack of music. Because a lot of modern directors, you know when to use music and particularly when not to use music. And in some cases, some of these scenes really work better as they were originally done. One of those movies is Frankenstein. Now, the first Frankenstein movie, 1931, directed by a really fine director, James Whale, is a master of the expressionist style. Boris Karloff's first appearance as the monster, right, that incredible makeup, is in complete silence. They do a series of what are called jump cuts, and that is sudden close-ups without any preparation. And to this day, I think this scene is chilling. And when you look in his eyes and you can see that this is a completely insane, evil being, it still works. See for yourself. That seems almost worthy of a Robert Altman or something. It's really well done. Now, just within a few years, this is Universal, right? Was one of the sort of poor stepchildren in Hollywood studios. The whole business of using background scores had begun. So if Universal had made Frankenstein just a few years later, let's say about 34 or 35, it would have had a background score all the way through. And what they would have used would be those same old cues that they had been using for the silent movies. It would have all been the same stuff, but now it would come out of the speaker in the movie theater. So here's how this scene might have sounded. By the way, I have access to all these modern, wonderful editing tools that they didn't have, and I can sit on my computer at home and I can do this, all of this that would have taken a whole staff of people to do before, and I can just do it in 35 seconds sitting there. Modern life. So here's Frankenstein now with about a 1935 style background score. So the moral of the story is more is not always better, right, by any means. Now, what had happened? What had happened between 1931 and about 1935-ish or so? What had happened? Well, what had happened, and I'm speaking here in Hollywood, is that Hollywood had attracted a lot of first-generation, second-generation film score writers. Now, most of these writers had come out of the great European conservatories. Many of them had been trained in places like the Paris Conservatoire or Leipzig, and they were all soaked in the late 19th century idiom. So they were all fascinated with the music of people like Wagner, of course, and Mahler, Richard Strauss, especially Richard Strauss. And they brought that idiom with them to Hollywood. So it became, the Hollywood sound became kind of incongruous because it was actually a 19th century sound. You've got cowboys riding off into the sunset to music that would have been perfectly in place in a, you know, in a great big opera house somewhere in Europe. But it's a sound that we associate with Hollywood in particular in this time, and it's quite wonderful as long as you kind of ignore the fact that it's completely out of place. Now, of these scorers, these people, probably the best, certainly Korngold. Erich Wolfgang Korngold, he was a phenomenal child prodigy. And some of his work, which was all with Warner's, Captain Blood, Robin Hood, Seahawk, these are all Errol Flynn movies, right? And then Max Steiner, who's the grandfather of all of them. Max Steiner's the guy that really invented it all. And I'll be talking about him more in a moment, King Kong Gone with the Wind. Franz Waxman, who is often forgotten now, but he wrote some of the best stuff. Bride of Frankenstein has got to be one of the greatest of all-time movie scores, not to mention Sunset Boulevard. Woo! Now, the movie that really did it was King Kong. You know, it was such an incredible movie for special effects and so on, but a lot of people forget that it was also the breakthrough film score of all times. King Kong established the style and the idioms of movie scores for about the next 20 years. Now, he used three techniques that had already been used in the silent films, but now he really used these techniques to their fullest. First, Steiner used leitmotifs, just as in a Wagnerian opera. A leitmotif is a little snippet of melody that is associated with a character or a situation. Now, in that, it's not so important, but the fact is it develops along with the character. So as the character goes through transformation, so does the leitmotif. And that's how that works. That's one of Wagner's great breakthroughs. He also used a technique we now call Mickey Mousing. We'll tell you more, but that's exact synchronization of sound to film, which in those days was really hard to do. And finally, this rather complicated word, diegetic, which means the film music mimics things that are happening on the screen. He uses all of these to great effect. Leitmotifs. Kong himself has a leitmotif, of course. It's just three notes. It's a descending chromatic scale. Yum, bum, bum. That's all it is. E flat, D natural, C sharp on the piano. It's the very first thing you hear in the movie. That's his leitmotif. Whenever you hear that, that's Kong. Now, we all know the story of Kong, right? Kong falls in love with Ann Darrow, and then he is destroyed as a result of that love. So the leitmotif turns into a love theme. Yum, bum, bee becomes this. And then it goes on. So it becomes the love music of Kong for Ann Darrow. Then, as we know, he becomes a very noble character, right? I mean, everybody always mourns for Kong, you know, when he dies at the end. And so it becomes also a tragic theme as well. For example, as we hear it at the end, it's a great tragedy. So it becomes all of these things as it progresses. So that's what a leitmotif is and how it works. Now, another thing he does in here is Mickey Mousing. And this is this exact synchronization of music to screen. This was really hard to do back then. They didn't even have what's called a click track, where you have little markers on the film as it's playing. They just had to do it standing in front of the orchestra, conducting them, and hoping they got it right. And if they didn't get it, they had to do it over again until they did get it. And so that's how it had to be done. There was absolutely no tools to do it, which means that the scene I'm going to show you is a tour de force. And most people just take it for granted because nowadays you can do this in software with a few markers here and there and you're done. But he couldn't do it that way. This is the scene where they go to Skull Island and the natives see Ann Darrow for the first time. they're about to sacrifice another young lady as the Bride of Kong. Now, what happens is the chief in the village sees her, stops everything, and he starts walking towards her. And he walks down a flight of stairs. And Steiner writes a score that's it goes boom, 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 beep, boom, boom, boom. But the chieftain isn't walking steadily. And there are times when it cuts away from him, and you see reaction shots. So Steiner had to work all this out in his head, memorize it, and then conduct the orchestra. I don't know how long it took to get this, but I got to tell you something. They nailed it. Here it is.
Baru! Markham in a toil and sorrow.
Here he goes. Bum, 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 bum. Watch his feet. Oh, there you go. Good. Speed up. Speed up a little now.
Hey, let's scram out of here.
Stand still, you fool. Steady, boys. Bluff them.
And he caught it right on. Bump. Got it.
One, two. Comedy, comedy.
I have no idea how long that took to get. Again, nowadays, nothing to it. But then, whee, yay, yay. Took forever. Brilliant. Brilliant stuff. Now, these diegetic elements are very interesting. What they are, basically, if, say, somebody's playing a trumpet on the screen, the score has a trumpet in it. That's how it works, essentially. For example, Skull Island, right, when they capture Andero and they're going to sacrifice her and all that, right? They're all playing drums. They're all playing drums. Well, they put drums in the orchestra. So I'm using for this is a modern recording of the Kong score, and all the drums are in there. Bang, bang, drums, drums. Pretty cool. Now, sometimes it's a little more subtle than that, though. One of my favorite uses of this happens in the New York scene. You know what happens, right? They capture Kong, and they bring him to New York, and they turn him into a Broadway show, from which he gets loose and trashes New York. Good for Kong. Now, how Steiner got the idea that we were on Broadway, because they don't actually tell you that. They just show you the theater marquee. Is that instead of using his big symphony orchestra, he used a Broadway pit band. And they play Broadway pit type music. So you don't need a sign saying you're in New York, you're on Broadway. The music does it for you. Seriously cool way of writing. So let's find out how it all works when you put it all together. The last big scene of Kong, I mean, this is certainly one of the most famous scenes in all the movies. He's up on the Empire State Building, right? But if you listen to it from the standpoint of the score, you realize that's just as miraculous in its own way. Steiner uses every tool he had at his disposal. He uses the leitmotifs, he used diegetic, he uses all kinds of Mickey Mousing, and he also knew exactly when not to use music. And that's part of the art as well. The great composer knows when the music should stop. Because then when it starts back up again, it's all the more effective, right? So here we are. This is the original film with the original soundtrack. The big, great last scene. Here we go. Here's the leitmotif right there. Up he goes. Up he goes. Mickey Mousing.
Here come the planes. Play them, Billy.
Leitmotif. Yeah. Da, da.
Don't get on the roof. I'll be shooting.
Up he goes. Up, up, up. No music, it's gone now. It's all the sound of the airplanes now. Nothing else. They are the background score now. Music. Because it's Anne. He's worried about her. So it's the love song, leitmotif now. Leitmotif comes in, and notice from now on the music tends to move downward.
Wait a minute, let me throw up, sir. My name's Denham. not Carl Denham. Carl Denham?
Denham? Oh, that's the man that captured the monster.
Well, Denham, the airplane's got it. Oh, no. It wasn't the airplanes. It was beauty killed the beast.
And then the leitmotif is a heroic tragedy. One last thing. Yata. Yep. And then finish it up. Was that it? So it's a masterpiece on all kinds of levels. By the way, I'm sure most of you know this, but you know that Kong is a puppet, little tiny puppet. He's made out of steel armature covered in rabbit fur. And when you see his fur rippling, it's not the wind. That's the animator's thumbprints. He was moved one frame at a time. That performance is Willis O'Brien standing up there moving that little puppet one frame at a time. 24 times a second, and he created that gorgeous performance out of it. Yeah. Yeah, Kong almost all the way through is a puppet. Every once in a while, he's a big head, you know, but most of the time, yeah, it's a puppet. And by the way, the armature still exists. There's a collector in Hollywood that has it. So, yeah, the rabbit fur is long gone, but still. Now, this is where it started, this brilliance of this use of ideas. And in many ways, I think it kind of came to a climax rather quickly. By 1938, this was a great art. And very, very, very fine artists were practicing it. One of the best, of course, was Korngold. We always think of Korngold when you think of great Hollywood epics. But you know something? He didn't want to write epics. He didn't want to write swashbucklers. He didn't want to write big blood and thunder movies. He thought of himself as a writer of more chamber things and love stories and all of that. But what got him to sign on to The Adventures of Robin Hood, which was basically the Star Wars of its era, you know, it was the great big IMAX movie of the time, right, because it was in Technicolor, wow, was the Nazis. Because if he stayed in Hollywood and worked, he could get his family over. And if he didn't, he was running a chance that they would be taken away because they were all prominent Jewish intellectuals living in Vienna. His father had been a major music critic, and he was one of the great talents of his generation. So he stayed. He tried to quit a couple of times, Hal Wallace got him back on. And the fact is, this became one of the greatest movie scores ever written. As a matter of fact, I think his movie music has really overshadowed all of his other stuff, as a rule. Now, what we have, this is really fun, is that not too many years ago, Robin Hood, in all its glory, was completely restored, you know, using all of these modern digital techniques. And as Warner's was working on the restoration, they discovered the original soundtrack without any of the dialogue or any of the effects, just the orchestra score. And they released it along with the Blu-ray version of it, so you can actually hear these scenes without anything except the score. You can also hear the playing of the most crackerjack orchestra, I think, in America at that point. The Warner Brothers Orchestra was one of the best in the world. Remember, they were usually sight-reading this stuff, as a rule. This score was so difficult, I think they were allowed to take their parts home and practice it for one night. But basically, they were just sitting there playing this at sight, and they just knock it out of the park. Now, this scene, we're going to see, this is without any dialogue or anything else. This is a scene right near the end where Prince John, who, of course, the villain, right, Claude Rains, is having himself crowned King of England, so on. But he doesn't know that his brother, Richard the Lionheart, is back in England and is under protection by Robin Hood and his merry men in Sherwood Forest. So they've crashed the coronation, dressed as monks. And so what they're going to do, of course, is Richard's going to show himself. He's going to say, "Are you a little premature about this coronation, Brother Deere?" And Brother Deere is going to say, "Get him, get him, get him, kill him now, kill him now." And all hell's going to break loose. And that's what goes on here. It begins with one of those diegetic moments. On-screen trumpets, well, Korngold gives us trumpets and the orchestra. I love this scene. Technicolor was so gorgeous. And when they restored it like this, oh, wow. Here we go. Thank you. saying, what right do you have to be crowned? And Claude Rains is going to say, because I am the king. Would you get rid of your own brother? My brother's dead. And guess who shows up? Ah! Richard the Lionheart. Thwarted again! Kill him! Kill him! Here we go! All real time, real swords. No stunt doubles. I tell my students, I know, mean, huh? As I tell my students at Cal, if you want to see the rest of it, rent it, you know? Because what comes is one of the great, great all-time sword fights, and it's them doing it. It's Errol Flynn and Basil Rathbone having at each other. So you could never do that today. Now, all this wonderful stuff that was going on, these wonderful scores, there was a backlash against them. You might remember that famous quip of Betty Davis in one of her weepies, I think it was Now Voyager, as she was going upstairs to die. She said, "Is it me going up the stairs or is it Max Steiner?" Yeah. And we have to allow the music is kind of incongruous, right? I mean, when you think about it, it's so good, but that's medieval England. They didn't have symphony orchestras back then, and they didn't have Richard Strauss and all that, but we loved it. So the next generation that came along, they thought, now, wait a minute. We don't need to have this one-size-fits-all kind of music. Let's make it fit. Let's create music that works, music that matches the style to the movie, that matches the instrumentation to the movie and all that. One of the great, great pioneers, of course, was Bernard Herrmann, an incredibly unpleasant human being, but an incredibly great film composer. And he would match his style to the movie, which means that as a composer, he's a complete chameleon. It's very hard to spot a Herrmann score sometimes because they're so different. For example, 1951, he more or less invented science fiction movie scoring. In The Day the Earth Stood Still, which is a brilliant movie, by the way, not that horrible remake with Keanu Reeves. Ugh. But the original is marvelous. And next time you watch it, by the way, note, it's a very well-disguised metaphor of the life of Jesus of Nazareth. Watch it from that, and you go, oh, wow, how'd they slip that one by the censors, huh? You know? Yeah, but they did. So he uses an orchestra of theremins, which is an electronic instrument, harps, vibraphones, all of this stuff, to create this unearthly sound. It's all a cliche now, but not when he wrote it. One thing I love about that score is it actually acknowledges that the 20th century was going on in music. You know, it's kind of so. He sometimes wrote great scores to kind of icky movies. For example, remember this one? Journey to the Center of the Earth. This is the one with Pat Boone. You know, yeah. Oh, boy. Oh, Arlene Dahl, whose hair never seems to get messed up. Yeah. It's amazing, really. But you know what he did, though, is he used these big Hammond theater organs for the dinosaurs, so to speak, which are actually garden lizards, of course, just, you know, but still. So it makes them scary, sort of, instead of just something to laugh at, even though they really are kind of funny. But his score, listen. Big organs, right? And I were rocking the floor. No music, just sound. Just sound. Wow. Just sound, 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 sound. Now, it's hard to believe that this is the same composer, folks, but Bernard Herrmann also wrote the score to Taxi Driver. And for that, he took on the whole idiom of film noir, and that's what he wrote. Same composer. This is his last score, by the way. Alrighty. But I'm sure some of you must be thinking, aren't you skipping over one big part of his career, Professor Sir? Like that whole long time he spent with Alfred Hitchcock? I didn't forget. He had a long relation with Alfred Hitchcock. It was kind of stormy. But they fought. Well, they actually fought like cats and dogs most of the time. But they did create some incredible stuff. Truly incredible stuff. And again, every one of his scores is perfectly tailored. So in this one, now my kids at Cal never know what I'm talking about until I get to it. You all do. This is one of the greatest red herrings in all movie history. A young woman has stolen money from her employer so that she can go find her lover who can't marry her because he's being eaten up alive by alimony. And so the idea is she'll take the money and say, hey, we can get married now. I've got all this money, you know. And where did you get it, honey? I won't tell you. You know, she stole it. She drives for 2 days over the deserts from Arizona to Southern California. She gets in a rainstorm, and she pulls off into a little roadside hotel. Uh-huh. Has a very intimate conversation with the sort of quirky but attractive young proprietor. And she decides during the course of the conversation, she realizes what an idiot she's been, and she decides, I'm going back to Phoenix tomorrow morning, I'm going to make this right, you know, and so on. So she goes back to her hotel room. The money is folded up in a newspaper, by the way, and she decides to go to bed. This is like half an hour into the movie. Imagine not knowing what's coming. Some of you may not. No music. No music. Notice? Yeah, he's preparing you. Here it comes. And notice lack of music now. No music. Hear this? Yeah. And then... Janet Lee had to hold this pose so they could get the little water drop dripping off her eyebrow. If you watch really carefully, you can see that her iris is moving just a little bit. And then we finally see the money over there in the newspaper. It's going to wind up in a swamp. Yeah.
Mother, oh God,
blood, blood. First time I saw that was in a drive-in, and my dad had to take me home. I was a kid. You know, one of the things people don't always notice about this score is that it's written for string orchestra only. There's no winds or brass or percussion. It's just strings. And Hermann chose that specifically to complement what Hitchcock was doing with this film, because partially for budget reasons and partially for artistic reasons, he used off-the-shelf, cheap black-and-white stock that he used for his TV show. And he used the same stuff, which is why night photography in this movie always looks like broad daylight, because it couldn't respond, and why it has that funny, gritty look to it. It's really cheap film stock. Brilliant use of direction. And so that's what Hermann was complimenting. He was complimenting that film stock by using a string orchestra, which is a little more drab. See? Now, I'm going to jump here a little bit after something. What I do want to mention is that concert-type composers, you know, the Stravinsky's and Prokofiev's amongst us and so on. During the 20th century, many of these composers did want to work in film because that was a lot of money. And in America, most of them were profoundly unsuccessful at it, very much so. The only one really in America who did any kind of work at all was Copland, and he got some stuff done. Now, in Europe, they did a lot more. But as a result, most of them didn't do well. It was people like Bernard Herrmann who really, really set the scene for the next generations. And most of them, I think their style to him. This is our great guy now, of course. Sometimes we forget just how good he is, you know, because we think of those big blockbusters. You know, we think of Superman and Star Wars and, you know, the Indiana Jones movie. Those are wonderful scores. Those are Korngold-type scores. I mean, Korngold could have written those. They're very much in his style. So we sometimes forget how brilliant some of his other achievements are when he's not writing in that older style, especially the Spielberg movies and the ones with Oliver Stone. The stuff with that. And so I want to end with taking a look at a modern film score that to me is as brilliant as they come. And that is the opening of JFK. This is Oliver Stone. Now, again, if you don't pay attention to the score, you may not realize just how brilliant this is. Now, you probably know the opening of this is a kind of a reenactment of the Kennedy assassination, intermixed with a lot of other stuff. And to do that, John Williams matches this kaleidoscopic style of Stone's with a kaleidoscope of his own, musically speaking. It starts out in complete silence. And then what follows is just the sound of snare drums. Funeral drums, military drums. It's the first thing you hear. Then we begin to hear a little bit of Eisenhower's farewell speech, where he talked about the military-industrial complex. And we hear what's called the JFK theme. Yom pom bida yom bi. Very noble theme. We then move on to a much bigger statement of that as JFK wins the presidential election over Nixon. So it's full orchestra at that point. It then goes to the Bay of Pigs and Castro, and it becomes an atonal score. It becomes completely 20th century. It's rhythmic, it's ominous, and it has no tonal center at all. It's a total change from what it had just been a moment ago. What follows is when the war is averted, he gets all gentle almost Debussyan with these little woodwinds and very sweet sounds. Then the presidency goes on, and again the full orchestra comes blaring in with the JFK theme. Then the Texas trip comes, and we go back to the atonal music, the ominous music, the music that sounds like a contemporary composer. As he arrives in Dallas, military sounds start up. We hear snare drums. We start hearing caissons, military drums. It all becomes very militaristic as we get into Dallas. As the motorcade goes along down downtown, the JFK theme is heard very low in the brass. You can almost hardly even tell it's there. It's all way distorted. And then all these military rhythms that keep pounding and pounding and piling up as the images get saturated more and more and more. It's a mix of real footage at the time and recreated footage. And then the shot rings out and it's silence. JFK theme?
But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security alone.
January 1961. President Dwight D. Eisenhower's farewell address to the nation.
Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic process.
Full orchestra.
November 1960, Senator John Fitzgerald Kennedy of Massachusetts wins one of the narrowest election victories in American history over the Vice President Richard Nixon by a little more than 100,000 votes. Alongside his beautiful and elegant wife, Jacqueline Bouvier, Kennedy is the symbol of the new freedom of the 1960s, signifying change and upheaval to the American public.
That all men are created equal.
The degree of mind and spirit that I possess will be devoted to the cause of freedom around the world.
Today, the proudest boast is FBI Belina.
He inherits a secret war against the communist Castro dictatorship in Cuba.
Now, this is the ominous music.
By the CIA and angry Cuban exiles. Castro is a successful revolutionary, frightening to American business interests in Latin America. This war culminates in the disastrous Bay of Pigs invasion in April 1961, when Kennedy refuses to provide air cover for the exiled Cuban brigade. Kennedy, taking public responsibility for the failure, privately claims the CIA lied to him and tried to manipulate him into ordering an all-out American invasion of Cuba.
El problema de Cuba.
In October 1962, the world comes to the brink of nuclear war when Kennedy quarantines Cuba after announcing the presence of offensive Soviet nuclear missiles 90 miles off American shores. Soviet ships with more missiles sail towards the island, but at the last moment, they turn back. The world breathes with relief. In Washington, rumors abound that JFK has cut a secret deal.
Now notice the woodwinds.
Premier Khrushchev. Not to invade Cuba.
War has been averted.
Turn for a Russian withdrawal of missiles. Suspicions abound that Kennedy is soft on communism.
Orchestra.
Kennedy also
JFK.
Finds himself embroiled in Laos and Vietnam.
We've got our difficulties there, quite obviously.
Unless a greater effort is made by the government to win popular support, I don't think that the war can be won out there. In the final analysis, it's their war. They're the ones who have to win it or lose it.
Early that fateful summer, Kennedy speaks of his new vision at the American University in Washington.
What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana, enforced on the world by American weapons of war. We must re-examine our own attitudes towards the Soviet Union. Our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet.
Notice it's all strings.
We all breathe the same air.
All strings.
We all cherish our children's futures, and we are all mortal.
Now. Atonal.
You fucking asshole! You come back here!
He's coming to Dallas.
We're going up to Dallas.
Snare drum startup. Drums just take over at this point. Snare drums. And then in Dallas, we're going to get a new rhythm. That's going to start in a moment. There it is. It's a funeral march. Fast. That's what it is. You hear the JFK theme underneath in the tuba. If there's an art to film scoring, that's it. And every one of his best film scores has that level of brilliance, any of them. Schindler's List, Close Encounters, AI, Artificial Intelligence, which makes brilliant use of like John Adams-type minimalism, all of them. It's all around us now, this kind of brilliance. For example, 2 weeks ago, I saw the new Mission Impossible movie. Fabulous score. I want to go see it again just to do that score. It's just incredible. So it's really a wonderful, great art. Once in a while, when you're at the movies or you rent something, just pay attention to the score. You may be surprised. There's a whole dimension there you didn't even know about. All righty. Let's get the lights up, and let's have some questions. All righty? Thank you. It's like the end of the movies, right? Everybody's all right. So do we have collected questions, or how are we doing this?
We have some questions. Well, first of all,
Enrico Morricone wrote the score. Thank you. I was wondering who wrote that Mission Impossible score. That's really good.
First, let's thank Scott Fogelsong for his comments here today. Wonderful, wonderful presentation.
Thank you.
For the recording, I'm Linda Calhoun, Vice Chair of the Club's International Relations Forum, and I'll be moderating today's audience question period. So do we have any question cards filled out? Okay, well, I'll start, and maybe I'll pass the mic around. You were talking about Mission Impossible,
mm-hmm.
Scott. What do you think? I mean, I've seen a lot of films lately that Philip Glass has scored. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you think of him, and is he the rightful successor to John Williams?
Well, is he the rightful successor? I would say no, because they're the same generation, for one thing. So, but it's a complete his is a completely different aesthetic, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's the creating of music that's like a tapestry of color that doesn't change the way. He doesn't interpret in his scores the way that John Williams does. What he does is he writes a steady score that goes underneath. It's a very different approach. You can imagine it would not work worth a darn with something like this. But with something else, it might. Very much so.
Mm-hmm. And now from this one question card I have, the person writes, do you know who the woman who was in the hospital bed that was warning about the Kennedy assassination?
Well, no, we've never met. I do not know who the actress is, but it's quite a little bit of acting, isn't it? Yeah, it's quite good. Yeah, no, I'd have to look that up somewhere.
Okay, I'm
going to go ahead. I have to tell you, I was 7 then, so, you know, it was, yeah.
Okay, so we have a question.
Yeah, yes. What was the level of Hollywood composing before the refugees came from
Italy? The level of Hollywood composing was that stuff you were hearing in the Frankenstein movie. It was mostly hack stuff. Every once in a while, some good music got through, but basically, those Hollywood guys were there by 1931 or 32, and so if you think about regular scoring, didn't start really until the late 20s. So there wasn't much time. Most of the early sound movies were musicals. Because everybody would accept that, and a whole lot of those, and of course, just sometimes watching people sit there and talk was plenty. I don't know if you've seen some of those very early ones. They hadn't invented the hanging boom yet. And so they've got the mic somewhere between them, and they're trying to hide it, like the guy's talking into the telephone that's on the desk, because that's where the microphone is, like that, or the way that Al Jolson hugs with his mom in that one scene, because the microphone's right there. So there was there wasn't a lot of it. What there was kind of drecky on the whole, for the most part.
And I'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to The Music of Cinema with Professor Scott Fogelson.
Thank you.
We have another question.
We have one over here and one there. Yes. Mm-hmm.
When we go to concerts, if the music is new music, the atonal, mm-hmm. Sometimes it's difficult for some of the audience members to try to appreciate it.
Yes.
But in a film, when you mm-hmm. are seeing a scene, you seem not to mind.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And you seem to accept mm-hmm. it much easier. Mm-hmm. So
yes. Mm-hmm.
There is something about the visual and oral
yes.
that maybe pure concert-going people could be helped by visual.
I would agree with that. I find that a lot of atonal music on the whole seems to have found a very good home in the theater and the cinema. It works very well, and I think in some ways it works better than it does in concert situations. Of course, a lot of new music is very tonal, and of course, but I know what you mean by that, very much so. Generally speaking, when I'm dealing with very atonal music, I generally have a lot of visual connections with it. It helps me a lot, because I'm very much a tonalist at heart. I'm a theory teacher, you know. So, you know, and so on. So atonal music often kind of, you know, it kind of rubs me the wrong way, because I think, oh, they're breaking all the rules, stop it, you know, all that. So, but no, I agree with you, the visual can help a great deal. I think if you do have trouble connecting with any piece of music, it's just a Beethoven symphony for that matter, visual's fine. All's fair in love, war, and listening.
Sometimes when I really paid attention to a score, I looked to see who it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen Danny Elfman's name pop
yes.
up a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And he came out of the rock world.
That's right.
And I'm mm-hmm. just wondering if you can comment on him generally, but also mm-hmm. On some of the leading composers. What kind of mm-hmm. backgrounds do they generally have?
The backgrounds of today's composers, they're all over the map these days. Like someone out of rock like that. Don't forget that like Burt Bacharach used to do a lot of scores and all that. There are those. There are also quite a few that come out of the club scenes. Some do come out of the conservatories and so on. But on the whole, if they're coming out of a traditional training, they've probably brought a different mindset into it. Just to give you an example, some of our students at our conservatory who are film-oriented have a tendency to write very much like Stephen Sondheim. They've got a lot of that. So they really do come from a lot of different backgrounds. I think one of the things, and this is a much bigger topic we can't do today, but this whole thing between classical and pop and film and Broadway, all of those distinctions are fading fast. Today's young composers are usually very comfortable in any kind of area. They can write film scores, symphony. They can write for games, go write for theater, and they're good at all of it now. But many of them are not coming up the traditional way through the conservatories. Many are coming out of very different areas. But many of them wind up in conservatories anyway.
Scott, our next yes. question is here.
Yes.
Hi. Can you comment on the, as a child, I remember cartoons.
Yes.
And symphony music with mm-hmm. cartoons mm-hmm. and a Bugs Bunny cartoon with a Wagner score.
Oh, that was marvelous. What's Opera Doc? Yeah.
Can you comment on those?
Yeah, that's a classic. It's called What's Opera Doc, and it's a takeoff on the Wagner operas. It's just, if you haven't seen it, you must see it. Oh, yeah, kill the rabbit. Yeah. Yeah. Bugs Bunny is Brunhilde. Yeah. And don't forget the Rabbit of Seville, right? That one is that one. And then my favorite one is when Bugs Bunny becomes Leopold Stokowski and he torments the tenor. Oh, yeah, they're great. They're just great. They're wonderful things. And they're a great introduction. You know, I mean, to this day, I have trouble hearing the overture to the Barber of Seville without thinking of the Rabbit of Seville, you know, to this day.
Well, just yes. a reminder that the AT&T, I don't remember if it's yearly or biannually, that they do the Opera in the Park.
Yes,
and they
do.
Always mm-hmm. start off with those.
Oh, well, they're just too good. They're just too good. You know, there were also back in the 30s, especially Disney did all those silly symphonies, and many of them were classical music then with interpretive vision to them. And they're wonderful, many of them, you know, Flowers and Trees, things like that, those early ones. They're really good. Good way to get kids into the stuff.
My question mm-hmm. actually is mm-hmm. how are people breaking into it seems
mm-hmm.
like there would be so much competition.
Oh, yeah. Breaking into it, it's one of the hardest fields there is. Our music field is tough, period. But for these kids, it's really tough. A lot of them they get into an indie film. That's where a lot of them might start. You know, they write for indies and so on. And then maybe they'll get a bigger break that way. I have a former student that's been going that direction. But typically speaking, it's a very long road. And you either have to have a spouse who makes a lot of money, or you have to be very good at living on almost nothing. It's a tough life.
Unfortunately, yeah. We've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last
question.
Oh,
this is sad.
And okay. It's going to be you.
Okay.
Can you touch on when, like, a pop artist decides to do the whole soundtrack, or if there's mm-hmm. sort of a marriage between the film score, when there's generally an entire band? I'm thinking of mm-hmm. Mrs. Robinson, mm-hmm. Simon and Garfunkel. Mm-hmm. They did the whole soundtrack, as
That's
we
right.
think about it, but there mm-hmm. was still a score.
Right. That one gets a little interesting, because there was a period, especially in the 60s, where we had pop song scores. Butch Cassidy, Sundance Kid, that's another one. And that was a big popular thing in that era, where you had these, what you could call pop song scores. And Graduate is certainly one of the great ones of all time. Very often what would happen is the director would know some of these musicians, and then they would get together with them. I can give you an example. Another example of that is Martin Scorsese, who's done a lot of that. Typically, he uses recycled. Next time you see Goodfellas, you know, listen to the score. It's all recycled music from the era. And he uses that very much so. But that's how they would do that. They would know somebody they liked, and they'd work with them, hopefully. And I'm not going to talk about that horrible thing that seems to have stopped, and that is putting the puly, awful, treacly pop song over the ending credits. You know, I just used to almost throw up whenever they did that, you know. Do you ever see the Francis Ford Coppola Dracula? It's really stylistic. It's got this incredible score by Kilar. It's a wonderful, wonderful score. And then right at the end, as the credits going, they put this icky little wee pop song into it. And it totally, you have to turn, if you're renting it, you must turn it off before the end credits run. So that's a different animal entirely. That's not an artistic decision. That's the PR people. And that's sometimes you got to remember, that's another aspect to it, right? You know, we got to get Peter, Paul, and Mary to do this right now. They're hot kids. They're hot, you know. So fire Max Steiner, you know. Let's get Peter, Paul, and Mary. You know, that happened too.
Thank you, Scott.
Well, thank you. Thank you.